Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The first case this morning is A20-1531, State of Minnesota versus Gavin Patrick Meany.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is December 8th, 2021, and this is the first case of five we have on our calendar, two of which are before us for oral argument. I think you're both familiar with our procedures, but they operate very much as they do in our physical courtroom. And that is, counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes, counsel respondent will have 15 minutes as well, and then counsel for appellant will have 5 more minutes for rebuttal. If, I don't expect it, but if you have any technical problems as we go through this, just let us know. And we'll stop the proceedings and make sure that you get the time you need when we can hear and see you, because we certainly want to get your full perspective. During this time, you'll see, and it will become clear, I believe, that there is a time on one of our little Zoom boxes to help us all keep track of the time as we go along. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court may it please the court and opposing counsel, Ms. Kina. I'm Jennifer Lauerman, and I represent Gavin Patrick Meany, the petitioner appellant. The issues in this case involve the validity of Mr. Meany's guilty plea, the appropriateness of his sentence, and whether or not the district court erred when it denied Meany's post-conviction petition without an evidentiary hearing. For the purposes of this case, where the record is voluminous, I intend to focus on what I think are the two most complex issues, unless the court has questions about others. This case involved a plea to 4 counts of criminal sexual conduct and
occurred. Ms. Lauerman?
Yep.
And what are those two most complex issues that you're going to focus on?
The validity of his plea, and also whether or not his sentence must be examined regarding the length of the conditional release term that would be appropriate.
Okay. That seems like maybe that's all the issues, or maybe the sentencing issue, you're focusing on one of the sentencing issues that you've raised. Could you, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just before you go further, on the sentencing issues, are you challenging the sentences in the form of a direct appeal, or are you challenging the post-conviction court's denial of your arguments concerning sentencing, or both?
Both. The issues as far as whether or not Hernandezing was appropriate and whether or not his conduct was unfairly exaggerated by his sentence, those issues were raised below prior to the remand for post-conviction. Those issues were not entirely dealt with in the district court's order, and we are certainly not waiving those issues that were there.
Okay. I apologize again for interrupting. I'll let you resume.
Thank you. This case happened in 2020, which is well after the distinction was formed in the courts between the consecutive and the concurrent entry of convictions in criminal sexual conduct cases. And that distinction is what is central to whether or not 10 years of conditional release would be appropriate or a lifetime conditional release. As the court is aware, Nodes was the case in 2015 that found that even if it was just a minute amount of time before the convictions, it was appropriate that the first one could be the previous or prior that could result in lifetime conditional release. The first unpublished decision on concurrent convictions was Rechtal, which was in 2015, and it was A14-1364. That case came out on November 16th of 2016. And that was the first unpublished case that dealt with it. But that and Rechtal's progeny resulted in Brown, which happened in 2019. And Rechtal was a plea case, not unlike this. Brown was a tried case. So there's a slight distinction there. The problem that we have in this case, or one of the problems that we have in this case, is that the court here deferred accepting the pleas at the plea hearing. And then the record is silent at the sentencing hearing as to the court actually accepting the pleas and putting that on the record. The court never said, I'm accepting your pleas. The court never said, I'm accepting your plea to count two, count three. There's nothing in the transcript from sentencing of the court doing that. We are asking for the matter to be remanded to the district court for the court to exercise its discretion as to whether or not to enter his conviction sequentially or simultaneously, and for the court to impose then the appropriate conditional release terms under the holdings in Brown and Nodes. If the court does that, and it determines that lifetime conditional release is appropriate, then the district court should allow Mr. Meany an opportunity to withdraw his plea if he chooses, because his plea would not be intelligent as it was entered, since he received affirmative misadvice from counsel during his plea hearing, when his counsel told him, you'll get 10 years of conditional release. And he said that on the record, as well as—
How is this case not like the Supreme Court case? Because in this case, the PSI noted that there was a lifetime conditional release and also recommended 153 months in custody, but that's not what the judge imposed. But the PSI, which Mr. Meany's attorneys, and he affirmed that they had gone over it, it said a lifetime conditional release.
I'm glad you asked that question. Rhodes is really about whether or not the government can add conditional release if the defendant was given no notice and they didn't object at sentencing. This case is different. This case is about what to do when a defendant receives affirmative misadvice about the maximum length of conditional release that they can have. And also, because this case happened in 2020 versus back when Rhodes did, we have the additional issue that the court has failed to use its discretion in entering simultaneous or sequential convictions. And thus the court had discretion on whether or not it would be 10 years or lifetime.
So if I may take you back to an issue you raised earlier, you talked about how the court deferred accepting the pleas, but never explicitly did that at the sentencing hearing.
Right.
But I just didn't see that. I'm looking again at your brief, front and center in your brief. So I didn't see that as an issue you raised. Are you trying to then, but I understand you're then, now you're trying to fold that into your, this is evidence that the court didn't exercise its discretion, or how do we look at that issue, which you didn't label as an issue?
I thought that I was clear in my briefing and in the post-conviction that was filed. Perhaps I wasn't clear enough in explicitly saying that.
And maybe I should go back and look at the post-conviction. I was just looking at the issues you teed up in the appellant's brief.
And I realized the briefing is voluminous, and the issue for me was how to bring this all forward in a clear, concise manner. And that's why I requested argument, because I don't think there is a clear way to do everything in this case. But that was the central issue, is that they deferred acceptance and then they never said anything. And the prosecution addresses that in their response brief by saying, look at the unpublished Johnson case, look at the fact that it was Hernandez. So we can assume that they were sequential, but that's not an assumption that this court should make.
My problem in looking at your argument that the court didn't exercise its discretion, so we need to send it back, is where, you know, here, just looking at the transcript, you know, the court goes on about the Hernandizing and then, you know, thinks that, you know, 100, I think it was 60 or 80, 180 months was too, you know, was still too much. So decides to Hernandize, but then reduces the sentence to 90 months. I mean, that's clearly, to me, a judge sorting through things and exercising his discretion. How am I wrong about that?
The record is clear. At sentencing, the judge asked, what is the applicable conditional release term? And the state said it's lifetime. Nobody ever realized, it's not clear from the PSI or from that exchange or from the 10 years that's on the plea petition and what his attorney told him, that anyone that whether or not these convictions were simultaneous or sequential was an issue that was squarely before the court. And even after the post-conviction, where I attempted to raise that issue, the court still didn't address it in its order on the post-conviction.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying about the plea petition, but when I looked at the sentencing worksheet and the PSI, I mean, tell me how that was not clear, that if you Hernandez so kind of for the second count, it's lifetime conditional release. I mean, that, those are the words on the PSI, as I recall.
Hernandezing, though, isn't how you get to lifetime conditional release. Lifetime conditional release requires a previous or prior conviction under 609-3455. It's a different analysis, and the courts have made that analysis. Are the convictions entered simultaneously or sequentially? That is what the court looks at in Brown. That's what they looked at in Rechtdahl and its progeny. That's what they looked at in Knowles.
But isn't sentencing under Hernandez inevitably sequential?
If you look at what Hernandezing is, you give a point for every conviction for which a sentence has been stayed or imposed. You could have convictions that were entered at the same time, and as soon as you sentence the first one, you've got a conviction and a sentence that was stayed and imposed before you go to sentence the next one.
But the conviction, my understanding is that the announcement of both the conviction and the sentence is the conviction, the adjudication of guilt and the sentence together is the conviction, and that a district court should, under the Hernandez method, do both of those things, the adjudication of guilt and the sentence with respect to each charge sequentially, and must do it if they don't arise from the same course of conduct, right?
60902 clearly and unambiguously provides that a conviction occurs when the district court accepts the plea and the acceptance is in the record.
And records it, which occurs on the record at the sentencing hearing, right?
It did not in this case.
But ordinarily it would.
Ordinarily, yes. But that's not what happened here.
I mean, would you agree that Hernandez was mandatory here? Under the sentencing guidelines?
I certainly would agree that it was an option that the court had.
But I mean, 2B1E says the district court must, I have it here somewhere. Multiple offenses sentenced at the same time before the same court must be sentenced in the order in which they occurred. The only exceptions are if there was a single course of conduct, and there can be no argument in this case that there was a single course of conduct, right?
There was an argument below as to whether or not it was a single course of conduct. The district court found that it was not.
And you're not challenging that.
So,
I mean, would you agree that under the sentencing guidelines, the sequential Hernandez method is required by law?
The Hernandez method is certainly allowed by law.
Required? The
yes.
word must is used.
Yes, yes. But again, because we have the Knowles decision and Brown, lifetime conditional release is not required, even if these are Hernandezed.
I have a question about your ineffectiveness claim. The Strickland Hill v. Lockhart test has two prongs. The second one, you have to prove ultimately that your client, if he had not received misadvice, would have not pleaded guilty and decided to go to trial, right?
Correct.
I mean, I know he said so, but that seems a little bit like a remote possibility in this case. I mean, he had previously admitted to the offense. He took a straight plea, correct?
Correct. He did take a straight plea.
I mean, and he has submitted a pro se supplemental brief in which he said, I had a romantic relationship with a patient. We engaged in mutual masturbation. I am ridden with guilt. I mean, I don't understand why. What would be his advantage in going to trial and not choosing to plead guilty if he understood that the registration and the conditional release terms were different than what he otherwise understood?
If he would have properly known that he faced essentially a life sentence, which is what lifetime conditional release is, he may have chosen to proceed to trial and take that risk.
May have or would have?
Would have is what he has said in his affidavit. He would have proceeded to trial.
And is the post-conviction court obligated to accept that as true?
The post-conviction court can make its own judgments as to his credibility. But here we asked for a hearing and the court did not grant a hearing. And there certainly were issues that would have presented issues that could have been dealt with in a hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Lauerman. Your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal unless either panel member has another question at this time. Thank you. Ms. Light, we'll turn to you.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. I would agree with opposing counsel that this is a quite complicated case. There's several issues that are pretty intertwining. And so I hope our argument today is helpful, and I hope I don't jump around too much. You know, I first would, talking about the conditional release term and consecutive versus sequential entering of convictions to trigger either the 10-year or lifetime conditional release term, you know, that case law is quite complicated and quite nuanced. And I think one issue I have with appellant's phrasing of the issues is that whether the district court exercised its discretion in how to impose or how to enter the convictions in this case is not how, that's not how I read the case law of Nodes and Brown. Particularly in Brown, the court made clear that the appellate court does not look at what the intention of the district court was, what, you know, how it was trying to exercise its discretion. The appellate court simply looks at what did the district court do? When did the district court adjudicate guilt and enter those convictions, and how did the district court do so? If they were accepted, if the pleas were all accepted as one, then it's simultaneous. If they are dealt with separately, then they are sequential, triggering the lifetime conditional release term for the subsequent convictions. So this court should just look at the record and determine what the district court did in this case. And the record is clear: at the plea, the district court did not accept the pleas at that time. It ordered a PSI and set the matter for sentencing. When the parties returned for sentencing, there was much discussion about Hernandizing. That was the main issue at sentencing. And as Judge Jessen indicated, the district court took its time and really thoroughly addressed that issue and determined that Hernandizing was appropriate, if not required, as Judge Johnson has discussed already. And so in doing that and making the conscious decision to Hernandize and then going through each count and sentencing sequentially, that indicates and shows this court that the convictions were entered sequentially, one at a time, therefore triggering the lifetime conditional release on the second, third, and fourth counts. So so a remand for the court to exercise its discretion is not necessary under the case law, nor is it necessary under the record here in this case. Moving to the plea withdrawal, there's two parts to that argument.
I just want to understand. So to agree with you, then we have to basically discern that the district court implicitly accepted the pleas sequentially because of what it did with Hernandez-Ising, not because, and that implicit acceptance of pleas, was there any support for that in the case law?
Well, you know, I think the record shows, you know, the case law is you know, when the pleas are accepted and entered, you know, and conviction is entered. And we don't have that at the plea. And, you know, I agree that, you know, the record, the district court could have been more explicit. It could have stated, I accept your plea, I adjudicate you guilty, and I sentence you to this sentence. The district court kind of, I think, unfortunately, maybe perhaps in, you know, trying to be efficient and kind of lump that all together. And so, but I do believe the case law supports that once sentence is imposed, conviction has been entered at the time that this, if it hasn't been entered previously, it is entered at the time that sentence is imposed. Does that answer your question?
That is helpful, thank you.
So under the plea withdrawal arguments, there's two issues. One is the intelligence of the plea, and the other is the voluntariness, which is kind of the ineffective assistance argument, if I'm understanding opposing counsel's arguments. And so, you know, I think just going to something that Judge Johnson was asking about and the prejudice prong of the ineffective assistance argument, you know, for that issue, I would kind of just to cut to the chase a little bit, I would say that this court could decide on the prejudice prong that the record is devoid of support that the appellant would have withdrawn his pleas and gone to trial had he known a lifetime term would apply.
Ms. Light, on that issue, did the district, did the post-conviction court make any findings on that issue? Or did the district court analyze that issue at all?
You know, I'm not recalling off the top of my head, and I don't have the post-conviction order right in front of me.
Yeah, I didn't see it, and so that's why I'm asking whether it was, or whether there were any comments on the record by the post-conviction court about that issue. But I haven't seen them in the record. So that I have a question in my mind about whether this court can make that determination for the first time on appeal.
I mean, I think it can under the standard of review, and you know, did the post-conviction court abuse its discretion in its determination, and analyzing an ineffective assistance, you know, encompasses both prongs, and so was the ultimate decision of the post-conviction court, you know, should that be affirmed, you know, I think this court certainly could. That would be my argument. But so, you know, I think on the prejudice prong, I think the Ellis Strong case is actually helpful in this regard. In that case, the court relied heavily on the fact that once the defendant learned that a lifetime term would apply, he moved to withdraw his plea right away. He moved to withdraw his plea before sentencing. And that indicated that he was misinformed. He didn't want to plead guilty once he understood the ramifications and he sought to correct that. Here, that did not happen. The record shows that the PSI was distributed prior to sentencing. The PSI and the sentencing worksheet were clear that lifetime conditional release applied. The appellant's attorney indicated on the record that they had reviewed that and they found it to be accurate. They reviewed it with the appellant and they found it to be accurate. And the appellant did not raise an objection, did not raise a question, there's nothing in the record to show any that was an issue for the appellant in pleading guilty or in being sentenced. And so it proceeded to sentence as if, you know, everyone was aware of what the conditional release term would be. So, you know, and there is case law showing that, you know, a post-conviction affidavit of appellant by itself is not enough for this court to find prejudice the record needs to also support those allegations in the affidavit. And I have that cited in my brief as well. So
that's
the
U.S. Supreme Court case that you're...
Yes, the Lee case, and then there's an unpublished case from this court as well.
Am I correct in assuming that it was the same judge who presided over trial who considered the post-conviction
That's petition? Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sorry to go kind of in reverse order, but so that's the prejudice prong, and I think that's, you know, a straightforward argument that I wanted to get out there. But then also on the whether counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable, you know, I think there's two issues. There's the conditional release term, and then there's the predatory offender registration term. For the predatory offender registration term, the record does not indicate what appellant is trying to argue. The appellant in his affidavit alone says he was affirmatively misadvised that 10 years would apply. That is not what the record on its face indicates. The record addresses the predatory offender registration term or predatory offender registration. It doesn't actually specify the length of time. So on that, you know, I would say that there was no affirmative misadvice. He was advised that he had to register. And so there's no performance issue on the first prong for that issue. For the conditional release term, you know, as I was saying earlier, the case law on Nodes and Brown and what type of a conditional release term applies is not clear. It's not as simple as just going to a statute and applying the statute. You have to kind of sift through this case law, you know, determine what the district court might do, how the district court might accept the pleas and when. And so even if the appellant's attorney made a mistake in saying 10 years would apply, that's not objectively unreasonable. That doesn't rise to the level of unprofessional conduct. There's case law saying that, you know, a mistake on its own is not automatically objectively unreasonable. And then furthermore, you know, that mistake was corrected by the PSI, by the sentencing worksheet, and it was never raised once the lifetime term was made clear. So I would ask this court to find that there is no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case on either of those issues.
It's like, if I may for a moment, take you back to the acceptance of pleas or, you know, lack thereof. If this panel, not saying it would, but if this panel was concerned about having to rely upon implicit sequential acceptance of the pleas and chose to reverse and remand just on that basis, what would the terms, from your perspective, what should those remand instructions look like?
I'm not sure, because to me it is clear, and I understand that the district court didn't use the words, "I adjudicate you," and I'm, you know, accepting your pleas. But to me, I'm not sure how we're fine. You know, I don't know how this court would find that the pleas were not accepted when he was sentenced, and because there is no record of them being accepted prior. You know, I guess it would just be an instructions for the district court to clearly adjudicate guilt and clearly state whether they are accepting the pleas simultaneously or if they are accepting the pleas sequentially. I don't know if that's supported by case law. I don't think that's exactly how these cases are analyzed or looked at. So I don't know if that would be appropriate, but I guess that would be the instructions to make this record as clear as possible. You know, lastly, in my remaining couple of minutes, you know, just turning to the intelligence argument of the plea, you know, I would, as I argued in my brief, I would say that the Rhodes case is directly on point. Yes, the facts are slightly different, but I do not think that those distinctions warrant, you know, distinguishing the case entirely. And in the ways that this case is different from Rhodes actually makes it a stronger argument that the plea was intelligent. You know, the facts are similar that, you know, there was a mistake as to, you know, the applicability of the conditional release term, but that the PSI clarified. And so the appellant was on notice prior to sentencing, never objected, never raised the issue. And here, how it's different from Rhodes is in Rhodes, there was an agreed upon plea negotiation with an agreed upon sentence. Here, there wasn't an agreement. It was a straight plea. So the appellant was on notice that the state was going to be seeking the maximum sentence allowable by law. And so here that makes it even stronger that he was on notice. He knew what the potential ramifications were. And he went ahead with pleading. And then prior to sentencing, he did not try to withdraw that plea. And he proceeded to sentencing fully, knowing full well that lifetime terms applied. So unless there are any final questions, I would conclude by asking this court to affirm the appellant's convictions and sentences. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from the panel, we will turn to you, Ms. Lauerman, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To go back to something that Ms. Light was talking about, if you look at how the district court actually sentenced this, on page 41 of exhibit 38, the district court didn't initially sentence them separately. The district court actually pronounced a 90-month sentence, then asked the state what the conditional release was that applied. Ms. Townsend said that it was lifetime, or affirmed that it was lifetime. And then the court imposed lifetime conditional release on the one sentence that it had pronounced. It was the state that then asked them to go through and sentence everything separately. So on this record, I don't think you can say, well, the court did them one after the other, and so you can infer that it was sequential. That's not what the record is. The record is it did it in one. Then the state asked them to go through and do that, and it did.
Do you think it matters that your client did a straight plea other than the state agreeing to dismiss? I think it was three counts. And he knew that the state was going to seek an upward departure, and the state knew that he was going to seek a downward departure. But otherwise, it was a straight plea. There was no other agreement. That seems to distinguish this case from most of the other cases.
It does help distinguish it. And to me, that makes the fact that he was affirmatively given misadvice as to his maximum sentencing exposure from his attorney even more important, because he was told he faced 10 years of conditional release. Then if we're going to rely on the PSI to say, well, he knew it was lifetime, the PSI doesn't say anything about conditional release could be lifetime. It doesn't talk about nodes. It doesn't talk about Brown. It doesn't give any hint that there is any discretion. And so that's what we have here that makes this very different from Rhodes. And also factually, in Rhodes, the prosecutor requested the 5-year conditional release at the beginning of the sentencing hearing. The court specifically questioned the defendant on the record if he had questions about it, and he said no. That's at approximately 325 in that case. Here, the judge asked the state, I understand there's conditional release, what is it? And then they never asked Meany himself, do you have questions about this? Do you understand it? And the state never asked for it. Nowhere in that sentencing hearing, did the state ask for lifetime conditional release? It was the court that asked, what is it? So they're very factually different. And again, this is a different case than Rhodes because we do not have a clear entry of the convictions. Judge Jessen, I believe it was, had asked what the remand instructions would be. My suggestion for the remand instructions would be that 60902 clearly and unambiguously provides that a conviction occurs when the district court accepts the guilty plea and the acceptance is on the record. And that's also in nodes at 81. That didn't happen here. The district court reserved the acceptance of the pleas until sentencing in index 39 at 21. And then the record is silent as to whether or not the pleas were accepted simultaneously or sequentially. This is not a distinction that is not without import. This has to go back for that district court to exercise their discretion and to clarify the record as to how those pleas are entered so that we can determine, and Mr. Meany has clarity as to what the correct length of conditional release should be. If it's lifetime, then the district court should allow plea withdrawal if Mr. Meany chooses, because he received affirmative misadvice at the time he pleaded guilty. And that affirmative misadvice was not corrected by anyone on the record at his plea hearing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your really helpful argument and briefing. The court will take the matter under advisement and issue opinion within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.